Welcome! You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It's very easy to find someone to blame and throw paint at, but it doesn't change anything. What changes things is when we reach out to each other and make those folks that oppress us irrelevant. That's when things change, not when we beg them, plead, petition, and give out this hope that somebody will appeal to someone's morality that what they're doing is wrong. No, it's when that what they're doing becomes completely meaningless because it doesn't matter to us anymore. We just go around it and deconstruct it and create our own realities and our own systems of respect and exercising power.
That's the voice of Dave Blakeney, postal worker, activist, and author. On this week's show, we speak to Dave Blakeney about what is needed for a genuine labor commons that is inclusive and capable of transforming the focus on jobs for a focus on justice. Stay tuned for the interview right after a short song by Dana Lyons. Stay tuned.
I was only 13 when they killed the Presidente. My family left the country when my uncle disappeared. They rounded up the unions, professors and the leaders. They ran out anybody who would try and help the poor. My name is Ricardo, and I am Patagonia. I was born and raised here like my grandfathers before. The horsemen drinking mate on that endless rushing river. They belong to Patagonia and the people who live here. Well, 17 long years later, we rid ourselves of the dictator in his final months in power. He robbed our country blind. He gave away the rights to our glacial mountain rivers, to his pals and corporations, the new kings of the land. My name is Ricardo, and I am Patagonia. I was born and raised here like my grandfathers before. The gaucho drinking mate on that endless rushing river. They belong to Patagonia and the people who live here. No one can own a waterfall, no one can own the sky. And I've seen the desperate sickness in the rich men who would try. No one can own the seeds of life which we all survive. Forever, Patagonia, may your rivers run free and wide. Now the price of power is going through the ceiling. They see a chance for money taken from our land. European company with a front man here in Chile. They smile and offer promises as they try and build the dams. My name is Ricardo, and I am Patagonia. I was born and raised here like my grandfathers before. Horsemen drinking mate on that endless rushing river. They belong to Patagonia and the people who live here. No one can own a waterfall, no one can own the sky. And I've seen the desperate sickness in the richer man who would try. No one can own the seeds of life in which we all survive. Forever Patagonia, may your rivers run free and wild. No one can own a waterfall, no one can own the sky. And I've seen the desperate sickness in the richer man who would try. No one can own the seeds of life on which we all survive. Forever Patagonia, may your rivers run free and wild.
That was the incredible Dana Lyons, and that song, Patagonia, really speaks to a time that we live today. You know, the way our society has been constructed around a set of narratives, a set of mythology of a market, a free market that operates and balances itself and somehow expands our opportunities for prosperity. Well, this metaphor, this very mythical story, has been challenged by workers worldwide. In Canada, we have a long struggle to recognize that the fight has not only been for justice, for equality, for access to a life with dignity, to a life with access to the basic essentials for life. Someone to speak about this is my next guest. David Blakeney is a postal worker who, for the past 15 years, has been the National Education Representative for the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. He is published in various periodicals, books, and publications, including contributions to Learning from the Ground Up, Global Perspectives on Social Movements and Knowledge Production, and the International Encyclopedia on Protest and Revolution. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Now, when we think about, you know, the last 500 years of resistance to the economic crisis, by now we all seem to be aware the capitalist system is a crisis system. What should we recognize? What are the milestones that we should, as workers, as people, recognize by now of this particular system of economic?
That's a good question. I think that we have to back up and just look at, if I'm speaking from a worker perspective and a labor perspective, that, you know, fundamental to our relationship with our bosses and capital, we do live in colonized land, and colonized land has created colonized minds. So the relationship of workers to bosses has always been more or less about, you know, fighting for some workplace dignity, working conditions, and to get a bigger piece of the pie. And, you know, as the economy expanded, you know, especially through the post-war period, you know, and people's lives, you know, seemed to get better from generation to generation, at least those in the working class, as unions grew and fought for a bigger piece of the pie, we never really asked, questioned the nature of that pie. What are the ingredients in that pie? The fact is that there are all kinds of reasons why workers have been detached by the more, you know, colonial struggles that have existed, certainly in the Americas, as we fought for better life and a bigger piece of the pie for ourselves and our families and so on. And I think that as capitalism is running its course and finding less and less places to exploit, the whole notion of austerity is now applied against all peoples and all classes, and so that it's a key historic period that, you know, we have to kind of shift gears as workers' movements and recognize that work isn't just negotiating, I don't know, some kind of a decent wage in the workplace, But work is, goes on all around us, unwaged work, work that people do to, you know, reproduce society, to raise children, to even fight for a place to sleep at night if you have none, or look for food that day. That's all labor, and it's unrecognized labor. And so we do ourselves a disservice as trade unionists, as workers, by this narrow focus on just our workplace, because, you know, our workplace is an extension of society, and if society is unjust, then those injustices come into our work as well. And so the old, you know, I'm sorry I'm giving you a bit of a long-winded answer, but I'm trying to focus, because these are really interesting times. But the game has changed, and those of us in unions have to recognize that the struggle is so much more about trying to hang on to declining wages and jobs and workplace benefits in a globalized economy. It's about the very liberation and freedom of human beings everywhere in each of our communities, outside, inside our workplaces, and all around us. And I think that's a really key change, or, you know, it's becoming more stark as time goes on, and capitalism is in such crisis of looking for new places to exploit. And I just say one more thing on that too. I mean, the notion of always having more and producing more and having greater production. I mean, our society is kind of based on this notion of more. And unions fall into that trap too, but in fact what we're seeing is we have less, even though production has increased overall and continues to increase. It sort of destroys that myth that, you know, the more you produce, the more you kind of get. And that's not really the case. It's really about maintaining a certain systemic order and practices that are unsustainable. And so that post-war arrangement where labor and bosses and management and capitalists and so on had of sort of this uneasy truce where we would go and strike at certain times and we'd negotiate some benefits and all that, that's over. That's dead. And we're still some of us are still behaving as though that kind of reality still exists. And the stakes are so much higher now.
It's beautiful that you point that out, because when we look at the way the world is described to us, it is described in such rigid terms, you know, of what it is, right? This market economy, as it's now being hailed as, you know, something that needs to be preserved, and we don't really have the spaces to discuss what else could be possible. You are one of the keynote speakers at the Tragedy of the Market, From Crisis to Commons, a Community Gathering. This is a conference that is trying to define a new commons. What should that commons look like, and what is the role of unions and workers in the creation of this commons?
First of all, we have to come at this as equals, that we have not necessarily so much to teach others as much to learn from others as well. I think we in trade unions sometimes lose that perspective and behave like a kind of mirror of the system that exploits us. For example, trade unions have sort of, you know, looked at the Occupy movement favorably, generally, overall, especially once it became popularized through the mainstream media. They certainly weren't there for the building and construction of the Occupy movement, which I think is part of that whole, you know, search for a commonality with many voices. And so our participation is sort of has been limited to things like, you know, nice speeches of encouragement, you know, some donations, maybe helping out buying some tents or some generators or something like that. But when we're talking about a commons, we're also talking about new forms of values, where things are given value that aren't necessarily material objects or a moneyed economy. But isn't happiness a value? Isn't the smile on a kid's face a value? Isn't respect between genders and honoring the differences between us, aren't those values also important? Isn't that maybe, you know, those are new senses of wealth that we should reflect on. Wealth isn't just about how much you have and how much more can be taken from you and this sort of thing. But wealth is how we live with each other. It's how we how we behave. It's how we move out of this colonized minds that we have, that we've been told the world is such a way when it really isn't. What we live in the 21st century is built on myth, and it's built on historical myths that certain people are lazy, or certain people are drunks, or that public sector workers are lazy, or that, immigrants want to steal jobs, or there's a terrorist under every rock, that we need more policing at a time that the crime rate has been dropping for years, that we're building prisons, more prisons. This is very disturbing, and I think we should all ask ourselves, is that the kind of world we want to live in? Is that the kind of commons that we want to have in common, where kids can't go out in the street and play with each other because, we live in this fear of each other, and the breakdown, sort of this individuality where we feel this sense of disattachment with others, So I think all these questions and all these things are—it's very key that this comes out. And one place to explore that is a conference like this, when we're talking about the commons and new forms of relation. Look, we're born into this world, and a baby doesn't come into this world ready to shop or ready to hurt others. Those things are learned. Those things are conditioned, and we've been living through that conditioning for 500 years in these Americas, not to mention, worldwide with the rise of capitalism. Of course, before that, feudalism and so on. But we're not meant to live this way, and we don't have to live this way. And if we can break out of those chains to actually have meaningful discussions about that, I think that's value.
That's beautiful, because not only do we create the world anew through our relations, but we also imagine our world through the words we speak, through the ways we frame our discourses, right? The kinds of discussions we have around the dinner table, or outside the church, or wherever the places we congregate. So it matters what we think is possible. It matters what we imagine to be possible. So how should we imagine our actions, how these actions taken to defend our neighborhoods, our communities, not just our limited interests of our employers or employment places, how should we imagine our contributions in a way that can reclaim local power and create equitable distribution of power?
I don't want to sound trite here or anything, but overly simplistic, but I do think we have to look that which is around us that we're immediately connected to, that we avoid, like our neighbors, like our immediate communities where we live. We've been taught to look outside ourselves. The elect a political party, they're going to change everything. Elect a certain leader, they're going to change things. Elect a certain union leader, they're going to take the union in a new direction. And through that process, we reinforce this notion that those kind of relations and that kind of expression of power happens outside of us. That doesn't happen within and around us, but it happens externally. I don't want to sound trite, but this past summer, I dug up my lawn. I dug up the entire lawn. So I'm just speaking sort of anecdotally now, but I dug up the entire lawn and planted herbs and flowers and so on. And I'd lived in my neighborhood for 6-7 years and really had no contact with the neighbors at all. Probably was in their eyes, the ugliest looking lawn on the street. But that process of growing food and flowers and herbs created relationships that I had no idea, could exist. In other words, I talked more about politics with my neighbors this summer and the world around us and the injustices, and made community connections in a way I'd never had before, only by changing the paradigm that we don't need a green lawn. We can actually have bees and birds and flowers and herbs and food growing on our lawns. And just that little thing, that tiny little thing taught me that, sometimes the way that we even go about organizing and relating to one another removes the human component. It becomes all about, meetings and, you know, somebody talking and a whole bunch of people listening. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's boring, and it's also not realistic in a world that has sucked so much time out of us, and where we're all seem to, especially in the big cities, to be on the run to something, or have to go to this, or have to be there, or have to pick up, you know, kids at school, or childcare if you have it, or whatever. And I know it sounds kind of simplistic, but it really made me realize, you know, how much that we bury that's right there in front of us that could be happening. So I think communicating with those around us in our immediate surroundings in meaningful ways, in ways that are caring and nurturing and loving and respectful and not being pedantic about it, but trying to break through those walls that we didn't put up. We've been trained this way. We've been told to act this way. We've been told to be consumers. And if you can't afford to consume, then we'll just throw you into the streets and blame you for being there. So I think the answers aren't as complex as we think they are. They're actually about reclaiming a human part of us all and engaging with that with people that are around us, whether, again, it's in the workplace or the spaces where we meet. And I love to see subversion of those meeting places, like, you know, like, say, malls, you know, where people are like, you know, a bunch of sort of, you know, individual shoppers. And even things like when people get together, I just can't think of the term now, when people get together and sing a song or play out an act or do some theater that's unscheduled, flash mobs. And my daughter was involved in one of those. She's 15. They did it in a mall, and they did an anti-consumerist kind of thing. People laugh at that. They feel engaged in it. They feel part of it. They don't feel preached at. It's a celebration. She sat in a parking lot last year at Earth Day, or in a parking space last year at Earth Day with six of her schoolmates telling people, leave your car home today, you don't need your car. And I think we need to create joy in our resistance and find different creative ways of doing that make people laugh and draw them in, so those folks that are fighting for justice in the street just aren't seen like a cult to other people who are so detached from that, but actually are engaged with each other in new meaningful ways that we can all find that humanity that's within us. I hope this doesn't sound too flaky or anything, but really, I mean, I think this is so important. The emotional is equally as important as the cerebral.
Absolutely. You know, and I just appreciate your words so much, because I think that there is a disconnect within the labor movement that still continues a tradition of leaders without realizing that a movement that is only focused on leaders, you know, what happens when you lose that leader, right? We need a movement that is more organic, that it's more inclusive and reflective of the multiple voices that participate within it.
Absolutely. I mean, we've become quite rhetorical. We're really good at it in the labor movement. We sing songs without really any meaning. We chant without meaning. And we always, again, focus outside of ourselves, looking for that leader, looking, hoping that someone will carry us, you know, a Jesus Christ will take us to the promised land, so to speak. And history teaches us that real meaningful change actually requires us to go much deeper and find and nurture the power that we all have in each of us that we can exercise. And also the way we play roles, that we're not all the same. You know, some people, you know, they've got a great deal of rebel energy. Other folks don't feel so comfortable with that, but they may like to, you know, to create art forms. Other folks may like to just help. You know, what can I do to help? And I think when we do this one-size-fits-all to activism, we do ourselves a disfavor, and it does become very hierarchical. You know, the most popular guy, the best speaker, the most charismatic, you know, and we're always looking for that without finding that charisma that we all carry in our own ways, in our own roles, in the way that we do things. And we can expand those comfort levels if we nurture them. and don't have this one-size-fits-all to activism, because that's a very capitalist way of thinking, too, that, you know, things are just a certain way, and if you're not that way, then it's no good. If that makes any sense.
The standardized model.
Yeah, the standardized model to activism. And it also creates a victim kind of mentality, too, because it's easy for a leader to get up and say, Stephen Harper is doing this to us, and he's doing that to us. And if it's not Stephen Harper, then it was Paul Martin. And if it was Paul Martin, it was Jean Chrétien. And yet nothing really changes, but it's a real safe place to be, being a victim, isn't it? It's a place where you can say, I'm not responsible. They are. I'm a good guy. They're the bad guys. Okay, right? But the system actually rewards the bad guys, and that's how it works. And by us maintaining the way we organize in the labor movement, we actually maintain that unjust order rather than start to break it down and deconstruct it. Because, as I said, it's very easy to find someone to blame and throw paint at, but it doesn't change anything. What changes things is when we reach out to each other and make those folks that oppress us irrelevant. That's when things change, not when we beg them, plead, petition, and give out this hope that somebody will appeal to someone's morality, that what they're doing is wrong. No, it's when that what they're doing becomes completely meaningless because it doesn't matter to us anymore. We just go around it and deconstruct it and create our own realities and our own systems of respect and exercising power.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for asking.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.